Okay, it's already, according to my clock, 9 o'clock, so we'll start. I just want to respond, as always, to some comments or questions. I'm looking at the list of who is on now, and I don't see his name was Shalom, Fishalis. So I'll wait till he gets on in a minute to talk briefly about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Agudas Yisrael, because he sent me some interesting information. And I will talk about that. In the meantime, let me just relate to some things we've done in previous classes, the sort of stuff that I know based upon the emails you send me that you find very interesting. In the last 2 years, 5 giant volumes, here's the size of them, this thick, by Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the son of Rav Avad Yosef, have appeared. More recent ones are called Shulchan HaMarechas. These are sort of encyclopedias of halacha. Also has 3 volumes called Ein Yitzchak. And I saw, obviously you can imagine there's lots of interesting stuff in these volumes. Just this deals with Dalit and Hay, this volume. And so Hay has hapala, abortion, and I saw that he quotes his father, and this has never appeared in print until now, because Rav Avadia has never written a response on this. But Rav Avadia Yosef permits, according to this, and has in practice permitted, not just in theory, a woman who was married and got pregnant out of wedlock, so the baby was a mamzer, that is the fetus, and Rav Avadia permitted an abortion. That was one of the interesting things in this volume. But on page 132, he deals with the things we've spoken about with the Krach Sharomi, with Shlomo Moshe Chazan, about non-Jewish tunes in davening, and cites everything we've seen, nothing unusual there. However, what I did find interesting was that what he says is not exactly the same thing as what his father says, Rav Avadia Yosef. One way more stringent, another way more lenient. Rav Avadia deals with it in Yavia Omer and also in Yechav Adas. Let me just cite this source, Yechav Adas, volume 2, number 8. And we've spoken... I didn't make that big. Okay, thanks. Rav Avadia says, you can, quoting the Krach Sharomi, you can use non-Jewish tunes for davening, things like that. However, he's not happy. Okay, I'm not sure. Tech can maybe make it smaller again, because I'm going to need to show pictures later. He's not happy with... by the way, this might be because I don't know if someone else has the authority to change the pictures or not, so please get on that. If you have an echo, I believe it's because you probably have your sound turned on. You don't want your sound to be turned on. Guys, you don't want the ability to speak to be turned on, Eva. If you look down where it says talk, you do not want, if you have that, you don't want it to be blackened. But let tech services take a look at that. On page 26, he says that it's preferable, however, that if you know the music, that is, he says you can use love songs. You can make the tune for Kedusha. Love songs. Can you hear me now? Can everyone hear me? Okay. I want to go back now. I'm not sure where you stopped hearing me. Someone email me where we... Well, let me just start at the beginning. It's only been a minute. Rav Avadya Yosef, in Volume 2, number 5, says that you can use in love songs davening. He quotes Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. However, he says that you should prefer to use Jewish music, but he says you can't say it's forbidden because we know many, many songs which were taken from love songs in Arabic writings, etc. He also says in Yabia Omer that when it comes to using Christian music, which is what Shlomo Shachazan said not only was permissible, but was done in practice in Smyrna, he says, Ketzat Kasha, this is a bit difficult. Okay. Also, he says in here, I can't find it now, that you shouldn't... And he says, incidentally, about using this love song, is you take it and you bring it from the Sitra Achra to the Sitra Kedusha. He doesn't say anywhere here that it's forbidden to use... He doesn't say it's forbidden to use love songs even if you know the words. However, in the Shulchan HaMareches, this new book which I just mentioned, this huge volume, he says two things that are different. One thing, he says, that you can only use these sorts of songs if the words, the people do not understand the words. Because I guess then they could think about the music, and that's not right. Rabbi doesn't say that here. He says that since the words have been forgotten, and now we have holy words, we can use it. But he doesn't simply say it's absolutely forbidden. But in this book, Rav Yitzhak Yosef says that there's no problem with using church music even. Not only that, he goes further and says that... back to words here. He says that the Chazanim in Germany would maviri minaginos mi beta vodazara sitra kedusha, would take the tunes from the churches and make nigunim out of them and use them for the davening. Why I find this interesting is because, first of all, Rav Avadya Yosef, although he says that Rishon Moshe Chazan permits this, he also says this is difficult. He doesn't say it's absolutely forbidden, but he says it's difficult, and he doesn't say it's permitted. Sort of is saying, well, ex post facto, this is what they did. Rav Yitzhak Yosef says it's 100% permitted, which I don't see in his father. And I don't know, I'm not an expert in the Chazonis. Maybe some of you are. I believe that the famous Nigunim from Germany that came from church services were actually done by the Reform cantors, and then the Orthodox cantors adopted them. But not that the Orthodox cantors ever had this notion that we should go take church music and use it. That's the first thing I want to say. Now I see that Shlomo Officialist is on, so let me respond to what you said. We got into a discussion about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and his relationship to Agudas Yisrael. We're going to speak a good deal about Agudas Yisrael today with Rav Chaim Ozer, and I'll go about 3 or 4 more minutes because of the sound problem. Shlomo pointed out to me an article that appeared in the magazine Darkenu, magazine in the 1930s, which quotes Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz saying that his teacher, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, supported Agudas Yisrael. So before I speak about this, let me say a bit about who Rav Baruch Ber is. Hopefully we'll have classes on him. But in terms of students of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, other than the sons, I don't think there was any...
anyone who was close.
And tech support. I'm holding down the sound button. You might be able to hear me now, but I'm going to keep holding it down. As we've seen in the past, occasionally there are problems with our technology. So hopefully tech support is on it. It is amazing technology, but occasionally we have problems. I'm going to hold down the button, I guess, for the rest of the class, see how it goes. I'll try to reach with the other arm at the same time. We have, first of all, Rabbi Soloveitchik in his book, Thinking Lao, which discusses Reb Chaim and his relationship to Agud. He has a very different viewpoint. That's not really the source I would cite. The source I would cite is this book by Tzvi Weinman, Katavitzat Heba'ir. He is an Aguda figure, Toen Rabbani, a very well-known Haredi figure. He's really the person who brought Rav Yashiv to public light, I think. He has a whole chapter in this book. This book is a book about the founding and the history of the Agudas Yisrael. He has a whole chapter in there about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and Aguda, including information that has never before appeared in print, unpublished information, letters, and he shows without any doubt that after the first convention, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, remember it was the second convention, didn't want anything more to do with the Agudas Yisrael. They didn't accept his 18 proposals that I mentioned last class. We have testimony of Rav Chaim's sons, not just Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was prejudiced against Aguda for his own reasons, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik and others. All I can say is that Rav Baruch Ber heard a comment of Rav Chaim, but the notion, and that was a favorable comment, the comment he heard. But the point of Rav Chaim overall was not in favor of Agudas Yisrael, not opposed to it like he was opposed to the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi he saw as a dangerous force undermining traditional Judaism. But the Aguda he saw as something that was just not a good organization. Run by Askanim, doing things that are improper, but not a dangerous organization. The way he saw Mizrahi. Okay, it's time now to go on. I have a number of other things I want to get to. I'll get to next week. I do see, though, I have my Mishnah Berurah here because someone made a comment, and I should have mentioned this just before, so I'll say it now with regard to the tunes. Because it says, let me open it up here, get the page. Some people have a problem, I know, when you have chazanim like Dudu Fisher. I was with him on Pesach, and he sings secular music. So on the one hand, you can cite the Krach Shel Romi, that says that you can use secular music and create the tunes for Chazanos from that, and that's 100% correct. The problem is that the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Nun Gimel states that if you have a Chazan, he's talking about the requirements of the Chazan, Hamanaval Piv, Oshemanagin, he uses curse words, Oshemanagin Bashiri Agavim, or he sings love songs, that is, that's the type of music he likes to sing. It says that you warn him not to do this, and if he doesn't listen, you remove him from being a chazan. So based on this, everyone could conclude that you can't have a chazan who appears on Broadway, does things like that. And yet, if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, and he cites, and it's the Heitav, it's the Magen Avraham, they all say the same thing, that when it says Shirei Agavim here, apparently, the true girsa of this, and I have it in my Mishnah Berurah here, the true note is that it should be Shirei Nachrim, not Shirei Agavim, non-Jewish music. So on one hand, that's even worse. That then Shulchan Aruch is saying that if you sing any non-Jewish music, that is, you like to sing non-Jewish music or perform with non-Jewish music, doesn't even have to be love songs, then you're not qualified to be a chazan. And yet, they all explain, what does it mean, non-Jewish music? It's referring to music's religious music. Even the Krach Shel Romi said you couldn't use religious music. He said you just take the tune and you make it Jewish. But anyone who likes to sing, I don't know if Irving Berlin, White Christmas would fall into this category, but non-Jewish religious music, that sort of a person is disqualified for being a chazan. Okay, let us move on. As I said, there's a lot more. I want to tell you about some stuff about Rav Goren I found, other stuff. But it's time to move on to Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. He ended last class with Soloveitchik's unbelievable exposition of the Das Torah notion, the Das Torah ideology, applying it directly to Rabbi Moser Rosinsky. And there's more to say about this. It'll have to wait if we ever do lectures on Rabbi Soloveitchik. As I mentioned, Soloveitchik would come to reject this conception of Das Torah. Rav Lichtenstein, in his, I think it's his eulogy of Rav Soloveitchik that appeared in Hebrew in the Gush Etzion journal, talks about this rejection. The truth is that anyone who was a religious Zionist had to reject Das Torah, because the propounders of Das Torah, the Aguda Gedolim, were the non- or the anti-Zionists. Although today, you can be a religious Zionist and accept Das Torah, but your Das Torah will be Rav Mordechai Eliyahu or Herschel Schechter, one of the religious Zionist rabbis, but this is a relatively recent phenomenon. Okay, let's go back now to biography. Let's do Rabbi Moser's biography. As with many, perhaps even most Gedolim, Rabbi Moser comes from a rabbinic family. We've spoken about how this notion that people have, that the great equalizer was the yeshiva, and that Torah study could take a simple, poor, ignorant child, someone from a poor, simple, ignorant family, a peasant, and make him into a great Talmud Chacham, and then he could marry into the highest families. It's true in theory. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg did come from a simple family. He's one of the few that came from this sort of family. His father was actually a cantonist. I didn't know this information when I wrote the book. Well, I wrote about it on the Sfarim blog. This information came out only after the book, that his father was from the cantonists. These people who were taking for 25 years in the army, and these were always the poor people, though, because the children of the rabbis and the children of the rich people, they were never taken. If you came from the lower class, almost always at age 13 or so, after your son finished cheder, he'd have to go to work. So in reality, the people who ended up going to yeshivas and becoming the Talmid Chachamim, those were from the rabbinic families or from the wealthy families. It's a nice notion, it's a nice idea that anyone can rise to the top, but it didn't really happen that much in practice. So Rav Chaim Ozer's grandfather, whose name was Rav Moshe Aryeh, he was the Rav in Eisheshuk. That's the city made famous by Yaffa Eliach. Thick book she wrote about it, although with the exception of the first 100 pages, the entire book, I think the book is probably about 500 pages, the rest of the book deals with the Holocaust era. It's only the first 100 pages, if it's even 100 pages, that deals with the history of Eisheshuk. If you go to the Holocaust Museum, you have that room there with all her pictures. That's where she was born. Rav Moshe Aryeh, Rav in Eisheshuk, later becomes Rav in a city of, it's called Ivya, a little town. We don't have anything in print from him, except for if you look at the old editions of the Note of Yehuda, the classic editions. In the back there, you have notes of Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski's grandfather. Who was Rav Chaim Ozer's son? Rav David Shlomo. David Shlomo Grzynski. He succeeds his father as Rav of Ivya. Before then, what was his background? He studied in the Kollel in Kovno. It was a kollel. It was under the direction of Yisrael Salanter. Question: this was the first kollel. This is where all the great students of Yisrael Salanter were, and like Rav Simcha Zissel, Rav Yitzchak Blaser. Rav Chaim Ozer was born in 1863, and as a boy of 12, he is also sent to Eisheshuk. Why is he sent to Eisheshuk? What's there? There actually were a group of people, all ages, sat and learned, and were supported by the community. There wasn't a yeshiva in Eisheshuk. There was a community of learners. I don't know if this was the first such community, but this went back a ways. And the people sat and learned, and were supported by the community. Ate at people's houses, did things like that. After spending a couple of years in Eisheshuk, Rav Chaim goes to Volozhin, the great yeshiva. Greatest of the yeshivas. Really, at this time, the only yeshivas were Mir and Volozhin. About 5 or 6 years later, you start seeing the flowering of the great yeshivas. You have Slobodka and then the other yeshivas that come along. It really is due to the breakdown of traditional religious life, the fact that people could no longer stay in towns like Eisheshuk and just study in the Beis Medrash and eat at people's houses. It was thought to be dangerous. You had all, the towns were going non-religious to a certain extent. You had all sorts of bad influences. So the yeshiva movement is based on an ideology that you have to enclose the young bacharim, those young men who are able to be influenced. They're at that age that they could easily be influenced. So enclose them within the walls of the yeshiva to keep out the winds of change happening on the outside. That's why it's precisely at the time that irreligiosity is growing in Eastern Europe that the great yeshivas open up, right at that time. He remains in Volozhin from approximately age 14 to age 19. And that's it. Gadol Hador, the unquestioned Gadol Hador in the 20th century when he was alive, did not remain in yeshiva for 10, 20, 30 years. He remained in yeshiva for 5 years. And while at the yeshiva, he becomes very close to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. After leaving Volozhin, he's invited to give shiurim in Vilna. Or maybe it's the other way. Maybe the records aren't clear. Maybe he was invited to give the shiurim in Vilna, and that's why he left. But he comes to Vilna to give shiurim, and while there, he marries the daughter of a man named Eliyahu Grudzinski. Eliyahu Grudzinski, no relation, by the way, to Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. It's not spelled exactly the same. Good question. Were Sura and Pumadisa also a reaction to social change, societal change? I do not know that. Person to ask is Yaakov Ellman. If you send me an email, I will send an email to Yaakov Ellman. I will ask him. He was actually supposed to come versus Scranton a couple of years ago, speak about Babylonia, what was happening in Sura and Pumadisa. That's right before, it was right before that he had the terrible car accident he was involved in. Some of you know about this, and he was really out of commission for very long. But I never got to hear his talk on the yeshivas in Babylonia, but it's an excellent question. There must have been some reason why they were established, but I don't know if it's in response to the same sort of phenomenon. Who was Eliyahu Grudzinski? He was the son-in-law of Rav Yisrael Salanter, of Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's wife, granddaughter of Rav Yisrael Salanter, and Chaim Ozer thought of this as a great zechus, a great privilege that he was in this family. His father-in-law dies in 1887, and Rav Chaim Ozer is appointed to take his place on the Beis Din, even though he is only 24 years old. The Beis Din was very important. In fact, the Beis Din was more important in Vilna than in any other city in Eastern Europe, any other large city in Eastern Europe. The reason for this being that, unlike every other great city, there was no Rav to Vilna. Every city in Eastern Europe had a Rav. Very important position. Think of the great cities. Think of Vilna, Ravitz Chanan, and the Bar Avraham of Avraham Shapiro. Vilna had no Rav, and I'll explain in a minute why not. The leading Rav on the Beis Din was Rav Shlomo Cohen, the great Rav Shlomo Cohen, the Cheshek Shlomo. He stands out very high in Zionist history because when Herzl comes to Vilna, he is greeted in the public ceremony by Rav Shlomo Cohen, who speaks very highly about him, makes a blessing for him. I believe it's Rav Shlomo Cohen actually holds a small Sefer Torah that they present to Herzl. He showed great respect to Herzl and gave him a blessing. Remember, he's a Cohen. He gave him a blessing. So why didn't Vilna have an official Rav? Well, this goes back to the time of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was not the official Rav. It was never the official Rav of Vilna. The official Rav of Vilna was a man by the name of Rav Shmuel Avigdor. Rav Shmuel Ben Avigdor, as you know, it's often stated. I can't do better than read to you what the Encyclopedia Judaica says about this. I'm going to pick my finger off the sound button and see if it still is broadcasting sound. Then it'll be easier for me to hold the encyclopedia. If not, I'll figure out a way. Now, I see that there's a problem where I cannot take my finger off it, but we will make do. So in Encyclopedia Judaica, the entry on Shmuel ben Avigdor, I'm going to have to look down here to read this, but you'll be able to hear me, 1720 to 1793. Well, I'll summarize it. It's mentioned that in 1777, the community decided to oust him from the rabbinate. There were complaints that he wanted to dominate the rabbinate by putting in family members. The civil government also intervened in the ensuing battle. There was then a temporary compromise where the rabbi obtained several posts for his family. He in turn relinquished several of his financial demands. But in 1782, the Fuhrer broke out again, and it was brought before several courts, Jewish and non-Jewish courts. You see, I'm not holding it now, and I see I'm broadcasting, but I got to look at that. It says, the resolution on the, of the community on the dismissal of the rabbi from his post was finally adopted in 1785 and was endorsed by the civil court in 1787. So the community kicked out the rabbi. In the second stage of the dispute, 1782 to 1791, Reb Shmuel was supported by merchants and artisans in the town who represented a new power in the community and demanded that the community alleviate the situation and associate them in the conduct of its affairs. Then it goes on that one of the chief opponents of the domination of Vilna by the wealthy was this man, Shimon ben Zev Wolf, who even brought false allegations. It goes on, etc. In the end, neither side won a clear victory, but as a result of the controversy, no one was thereafter appointed rabbi of Vilna. Since late 18th century, I have a rav. The article says that his writings, Shmuel ben Avigdor, his writings remain in manuscript, and he is one of the signatories of the Cheirim against the Hasidim in 1772. The Hasidim never liked the Shmuel Avigdor. They see this as deserving that he's thrown out of the rabbinate. There's another Avigdor, Avigdor of Pinsk, who was the real enemy of the Hasidim. He even went before the Russian government and spoke against them. So you don't have a Rav in Vilna. The Beis Din, therefore, is very important in terms of religious life. Now, as a sign that there was no Rav in Vilna, a large stone was attached to the Rav's seat on the left side of the Arun on the main shul. I tell you that this seat is occupied, that is occupied by no occupant, that no one can go sit there. And no one will ever go sit there. That's what it was thought. In 1892, after the closing of the yeshiva, the Volozhin yeshiva, Rav Chaim Ozer, he's still a very young man, he organizes a group of students that it was a yeshiva of sorts. They called it a kibbutz. Although in the way they would pronounce it would be a kibbutz. And there are many great men who studied under him. You often hear about people who were students of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, not students in Volozhin. They were people who were part of this kibbutz in Vilna. I'll give you some names. Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. A Mizrahi, incidentally, was a student of Rav Chaim Ozer. He is the grandfather of the Lindenbaum family. The Lindenbaum family, Max Stern married a Lindenbaum. That's the connection. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was Max Stern's second marriage. He married a Lindenbaum. I believe that's what it is. Mrs. Lindenbaum, if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, her first husband was killed in a plane crash. And she married Max Stern, so her children still go by the name Lindenbaum. I believe that's what the connection is. But the Lindenbaums are the grandchildren. Rav Shmuel Yitzhak Hillman, Rav Herzog's father-in-law, the Av Beis Din of London, was a student at that period. Rav Yechezkel Abramsky, the great Dayan of London, Av Beis Din. I will have a course, a series of classes on. Rabbi Eliezer Silver, head of Agudas Rabbanim in America, rabbi in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in Springfield, Massachusetts, a very important figure in Orthodoxy in America. He's from that period. Rav Moshe Shatskis, Balam Jarov, comes to Yeshivas Rabbi Zalchan and Yeshiva University. One of the people who gave the smicha exams, one of the most important people to teach at Yeshiva University. Over time, Rav Chaim Ozer becomes accepted as the most important Rav in the city. This is after Shlomo Koch passes away, obviously. And in 1906, he is invited to become the Rav in St. Petersburg. The important key in St. Petersburg, there still was the Pale of Settlement, but you had plenty of Jews living in St. Petersburg. They all had official permission. Jews cannot go to St. Petersburg normally. You had to. My step-great-grandfather and grandfather were Chazanim, and they got permission to go to St. Petersburg on the high holidays. They had to get special permission because they had to remain in this Pale of Settlement. But wealthy Jews were able to live in Moscow. They were able to live in St. Petersburg. So when they invite Rav Chaim Ozer, it's a big deal. But he turns it down.
and the community was so impressed that Rabbi Moser turned down an opportunity to go to St. Petersburg that they offered to make him the official Rav of Vilna. He refuses. He says, how can I be the Rav of Vilna? The tradition of this community is known.
It's a good question, Shlomo, what the type of nigunim they used. When my step-grandfather was alive, I didn't know enough to ask him this. What I did know enough to ask him was about his town. He was from the city of Novozibkov. If you know about East European Jewry, you know Novozibkov was the first town of the Aruch HaShulchan. It was a Chabad town. Rav Zevin then becomes Rav of this town. I helped to do classes on Rav Zevin. I read somewhere that the town was not Lubavitch, that the town was Babroisk. That was the branch of Chabad that, there was two branches of Chabad. Babroisk doesn't exist anymore. All Chabad today are Lubavitch, but could be a Chabadnik and be a Zionist, because if you weren't a Lubavitcher, you were a Babroisker. In fact, the Rebbe, the last Rebbe of Babroisk, Shemaria Noach Shneerson, dies in 1926, I believe, was one of the leaders of Orthodoxy in the Soviet Union. After he dies, most of them join with the mainstream Lubavitch movement. He was a very important Rebbe, and Rav Aronson of Tel Aviv was also from this branch. He was also known as Kapus. Rav Cook's mother was from this branch. So I got some stories about the town, and I, other than that, I never really got details, unfortunately. Let us continue. Let me stop for a minute. I have to let this guy in, Rodney. Every time I take my hand off the talk button, I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. Okay, I haven't lost it now. At the same time, Rav Chaim Ozer is regarded as the most important Rav of Vilna. And again, let me repeat that he achieves an enormous amount of renown, not just in Vilna, but all over the Orthodox world, by refusing to take the position of Rav, which would have been the most prestigious position in Eastern Europe. Kovno, I guess, would be second, but Vilna would be first. He also is now recognized by the early part of the 20th century, by 1910, as one of the most important leaders of Orthodoxy in Eastern Europe. He was not the leader. You still had people like Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and there was others, obviously. But he is one of the top leaders of Orthodoxy in Eastern Europe, and very involved in political Orthodoxy, in the founding of the Agudas Yisrael. Unlike Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who comes to the early meeting or meetings, and then leaves, never to have anything to do with it again, Rav Chaim Ozer was involved until his death. And Tzvi Weinman mentions, he quotes Rabbi Meiselman as saying that the family has. I said last class that it was lost, but he doesn't say that. He says that Meiselman has actually seen a letter from Chaim Ozer to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, urging him to return to the Aguda. In 1910, there were elections for the Crown Rabbinate. Eastern Europe, that is, the Tsarist Empire, which encompassed Poland, Romania, this is obviously Russia. The law was that you had to have an official rabbi, what they call a rabbi, and also there was a spiritual rabbi. The Russian government didn't care less about the spiritual rabbinate, but it needed a rabbi who knew the vernacular, who communicated with government officials when necessary. Therefore, communities had to have two rabbis. They had to have a functionary, one who would meet with the community officials, who would be in charge of marriage and death. And this could not be a person like Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski or others, other Gedolim, because this person needed to have a good secular education. First of all, you needed to speak Russian, but you also needed to have a certain level of schooling. The government required it. And communities, therefore, had a second Rav, a spiritual Rav, who asked them questions. The crown rabbi, often these were the graduates of the Tsarist rabbinical seminaries in Zhytomyr and in Vilna. They did not involve themselves in paskening shailos. That wasn't their concern. It was a parnasa for them. However, oftentimes, especially smaller communities, could not afford to hire two rabbis. So if they could get a rabbi who was also a crown rabbi, that is a spiritual rabbi together with a crown rabbi, they would like that very much. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was both crown rabbi and spiritual rabbi. And older rabbanim too, Rav Eliel Klatskin, very important figure in the Lithuanian rabbinate, he was also a crown rabbi. If you look in Gottlieb's book, Ole Shame, which lists every rabbi in the world, really, with their address and their biographies, for a number of the Russian rabbis, it says that he's also a crown rabbi. As I said, it was in someone's interest when they were applying for a job, the smaller community not have been able to afford both a crown rabbi and a spiritual rabbi, but Vilna could afford it. And So they needed a crown rabbi, and there were two people running for the election. One was Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein, a Slabodka graduate, a Talmud Chacham, and he was elected crown rabbi of Vilna. This was done with the encouragement and active support of Rav Chaim Moser. Rav Yitzhak Rubinstein was the Rav, was the candidate for the Orthodox, for the Aguda, and for some others as well. But basically, he was the Orthodox candidate. The non-religious, and Vilna at this time, I would say a majority was non-religious. Not a majority, half of it was non-religious, or almost half. That doesn't mean they could elect anyone they wanted. There were different factions. You had socialists, you had different types of Zionists, you had all sorts of types. But the non-religious had a different candidate, that is the mainstream non-religious parties. I'll talk about him in a minute. Rubinstein was later elected to the Polish Senate after World War I. Remember, Vilna was part of Poland until World War I. The candidate of the non-religious for Crown Rabbi of Vilna was none other than Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz. Chaim Chernovitz, who had also been, he becomes a rabbi in Odessa, later comes to America. Odessa was a very Haskalah-oriented town, so there he comes to America. He really leaves. He's one of the few people. We have obviously lots of people leave Orthodoxy, leave tradition. They leave it even when they're Yeshiva Bachrim. But Rav Tzair becomes a Rav, brilliant student and a scholar. He's the one who actually gives the most famous Hespedim on Maritz Lachon of Spector. He functions as a Rav and as an Ab Beis Din in Odessa. And although he's thought to be Maskilish, he is certainly part of the Orthodox rabbinate. He writes a whole kuntres on Erevin, and he's a Rav with a Beis Din. And he comes to America, and then you see pictures of him in America. He's not even wearing a yarmulke. And he starts teaching at the Jewish Institute of Religion, which, true, was not a reform institution. Stephen Wise was the founder of it. He later joins the Hebrew Union College. It was not technically a reform institution, but no one but people who wanted to be reform rabbis would go there. That is, that's who taught there, reform types and reform rabbis. Rav Tzair, although he still corresponds with people, you can see letters to him, letters to Rav Chaim Hirschenson by Rav Tzair. He is teaching at the Jewish Institute of Religion. There's a picture of him. I'm certain he has no kippah in Tel Aviv Judaica together with Einstein. And he has no involvement whatsoever with Orthodox Jewish life. So to have a case of a Rav, who was not based in a big city, granted a city that was open-minded, but still a city, to then go and just give it all up and just become a scholar and not only that, really leave the Orthodox world, quite unusual. The case that comes to mind, of course, is the chief rabbi of Rome, who apostatizes after the Holocaust, but that's its own case. He was a strange character, and he had abandoned the community during the Holocaust. Rav Tzair, though, just does his thing. And Rabbi Weinberg was very respectful of Rav Tzair. He thought very highly of him. If you look in the edition of the Tosa Choshen or the Sheif Shematzai, I forget which one, published by the extreme Haredim in Israel, there's a whole essay in the front of it. It was published by this guy Gerlitz, who's really on the right wing in Israel, on the right wing, really to the right of Agudas Israel. He has a whole essay on the derech in learning, the approach in learning, of the Ketzos HaChoshen. And after it was published, someone figured out that what did he do? He lifted Rav Tzair's entire essay that appears in his work, Total Saposkin, which you can find on HebrewBooks.org, and he just put it in the introduction to the book he published without telling anyone where it came from. Obviously a terrible thing to do, but it shows you how valuable this essay is. Total Saposkin, 3 volumes, great work. He also has Total HaHalacha, History of Halakha, which is completely not an Orthodox volume, no question about it. But Total Saposkin, it's great. And if you're really interested in Rav Tzair, his autobiography about growing up in as a Rav, about his grandfather, it's really a great piece of work. And he was a wonderful Hebrew stylist. And to his credit, he came out very strongly against Mordechai Kaplan. You can see the essay he wrote on HebrewBooks.org. I think you have to plug in, I'm not sure if you have to plug in Rav Tzair or Chaim Chernovitz. In any event, he was the candidate because he was so, obviously the Rav of Vilna, even the crown rabbi is going to have to be Orthodox. But for the non-Orthodox, the most Haskalah-oriented, the most liberal rabbi they can get is the best. And therefore, they supported Rav Tzair. And for Vilna wasn't like Novosibirsk or some small town. They weren't going to get any Shmo to be their crown rabbi. They wanted to get someone distinguished. They wanted to get a Talmud Chacham, but an open-minded Talmud Chacham, a modern Orthodox type rabbi. That was the agreement, that the crown rabbi would be a modern Orthodox Rav, and the traditionalist rabbi would obviously be the Gadol Yisrael. But for the more traditional community, for the modern Orthodox rabbi as crown rabbi, they want the most traditional modern Orthodox rabbi there is. And Rav Tzair was, I guess he was like a left-wing YU type or a Chavvei Torah rabbi in their eyes. So they vetoed him. And Rubinstein won. The fact that Rav Chaim Ozer was so supportive of Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein is significant, very significant, since later on we'll see the opposition to Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein becoming rabbi of Vilna, that is the rabbi of Vilna, not just the crown rabbi, but the only Rav of Vilna. The opposition to this, they cite the fact that how ungrateful he is. Rav Chaim Ozer supported him, really got him into the position as official Rav of Vilna, that is government Rav of Vilna. And later on, Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein tries to unseat Rav Chaim Ozer to take over the entire city. We'll see how this happens in a few minutes. But it's more complicated than that, because what happens is, during World War I, Rav Chaim Ozer left Vilna, along with many others. It was thought to be dangerous. He leaves in the summer of 1915. He goes to Homo in southern Russia, and later to Ekaterinoslav. Let me show you the picture here. Okay, I tried to get my little arrow there. It wasn't letting me. But you see where the star is, right above where it says Zaporizhia? Right there is Ekaterinoslav. And if you go just diagonal, about 2 inches, right above Minsk, you'll see Vilna. Chaim Ozer travels. Okay, thanks. Chaim Ozer travels from Vilna all the way down to where that star is. There are many people who are leaving Eastern Europe, leaving Vilna, places around that area because of the war, and moving deeper into. He does not return into the summer of 1919. That means that for 4 years, Chaim Ozer Rozinsky is not in Vilna. Rubinstein, during that period, serves as the Rav of Vilna, not just the official Rav. He also serves as the spiritual Rav. Tech support, I can't leave my finger. I'm going to lose the sound. Well, let me just leave for a second, and I got that's for the next class. That's not now. Things here are having a mind of their own. Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein had functioned as the Rav of Vilna for 4 years, posketing all the shilas, being Rav Chaim Ozer. He was serving as spiritual Rav in Rav Chaim Ozer's place for those, not just those 4 years, those terrible years, before. And many people were very impressed by him. Many people supported him. In fact, Gershon Bacon has written an article on the dispute over the rabbinate in Vilna. Gershon Bacon is a professor of Bar-Ilan University, an expert in East European Jewish life, especially Orthodox Jewish life. He wrote an entire book on the Agudas Yisrael in Poland. And in this article, he calls attention to the fact that this public support for Yitzchak Rubinstein, that's going to be seen very vividly in just a minute, as we'll see, brings to the fore a new definition of the rabbi, which we've really never seen before. The rabbi is no longer the greatest scholar. That is, the rabbi that you want most is no longer the greatest scholar, but one who is of service to the community.
Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein comes on the scene when Chaim Moser isn't there and shows that he is not just a Rav who's a Talmud Chacham, but one who serves the community in a way that Rav Chaim Moser never did. Apparently, what Rav Chaim Moser did as a Rav was what all Rabbanim do. Ask him shaylas, give shiurim, and that's it. Very different, incidentally, than Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's notion of Rav, and the most important thing, was to help the widow and orphan. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik did not give shiurim in Vilna, in Brisk, believe it or not. He didn't even give Shabbos Hagadol Drasha, or Shabbos Shuvah Drasha, except for the first year. He did not function, he didn't pass the Shaivas either, as we spoke about. So what did Rav Chaim do? If he didn't give shiurim, he didn't give drashas, and he didn't pass the Shaivas, he acted like the way a Rav should act, he thought. Involved in people's personal lives, helping them with their problems, being an intermediary between them and the government, doing all these sorts of things. I don't know who the crown rabbi was in Brisk, but we never really hear about him. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was doing all the things, and he took care of children born out of wedlock, all these sorts of things that many other rabbanim weren't involved in. The fact that the community as a whole votes for Rubinstein, as we'll see, is the new model of a rabbi, and the model we see it today. Think of our own synagogues. We all interview rabbis. How many, especially modern Orthodox synagogues, is scholarship the deciding factor? How you can preach a sermon in Europe, how you can preach, that was irrelevant. How you are in terms of your people skills. I think every one of our shuls will veto people who are not a Talmud great, who are, even though this person is a greater Talmud Chacham, because they don't have the other skills. I don't even know if being a Talmud Chacham is a, not just a requirement, but even a desire for most shuls. Yeah, I can think of some shuls in Teaneck where to be able to give a top-level shiur is a requirement. I don't know. I'm hard-pressed to think of a typical modern Orthodox shul where the community really cares. If this person had been, let's say, stayed in Kollel for another 5 years, even if it's a Yeshiva University Kollel, and even if he published Sfarim and is a great Talmud Chacham, I don't think that's what people today are looking for. And this isn't just a new thing. Don't go blaming the modern Orthodox. They weren't looking for it in Vilna either. Rubinstein, just to tell you a bit after, he ends up leaving Europe. He's fortunate. He's able to get out of Vilna in 1941. He taught for a short time at Rietz. Then he dies in 1945. He was given an honorary doctorate, by the way, by Rietz. Okay, let's return to what I was talking about. After the war, after World War I, Poland is created. It always had existed geographically, but it wasn't a country for hundreds of years. And the Polish government insists that the city of Vilna, which is under Polish rule now, appoints an official chief rabbi. No more of this crown rabbi, spiritual rabbi stuff. They want an official chief rabbi. And in 1928, the Vlad HaKehila of Vilna, there was a Vlad HaKehila, which had representatives of the Orthodox, the various non-Orthodox groupings, that ran the community. Remember what we said, there was no Austria, there was no religious separatism in Eastern Europe, where the Orthodox created their own communities. Every Rav in Eastern Europe was elected and had to answer to the non-Orthodox as well. So the Vlad HaKehila, which was dominated by the non-Orthodox and the Mizrahi, they're the majority, they nominate Rubinstein to be chief rabbi. And Rubinstein has the support of the non-Orthodox, Zionist non-Orthodox, the socialists. They were very impressed with how he acted, even though years before they supported Rav Tzair, they saw the way he had been as the crown rabbi, and especially during World War I, so they supported him, and also the Mizrahi. Stein was a member of Mizrahi. And the Mizrahi, in what in retrospect was a terrible thing to do strategically for them, the Mizrahi throws its support behind Yitzhak Rubinstein, even though in 1928, Chaim Moser Brzezinski was arguably Gadol Hador, the most important and greatest of the Gadolim. And the Mizrahi is an Orthodox party, and yet for political reasons, they throw their support behind Rubinstein. And this is always given as example of how the Mizrahi doesn't have Kavod HaTorah. Of course, it's complete nonsense, because so we have numerous examples of where the Agudas Yisrael has thrown their support behind functionaries. So the best example is the current chief rabbi, Aaron Metzger. Everyone knows that he wasn't as great a Talmud Chacham as the Mizrahi Rav Ariel from Ramat Gan. The Aguda themselves, numerous times, have thrown their support behind Rabbanim
that because they share their political outlook, they support them, even though the greater Talmud Chacham, which no one questions, is the Mizrahi Rav. But the Aguda argument was, well, but Das Torah, he has to follow Das Torah, so even if he's not a greater Talmud Chacham. So the Mizrahi was saying here that support for Zionism, religious Zionism, is more important than being... because obviously he's a great Talmud Chacham, Rumish sign, but he's not at Rav Chaim Moser's level. Okay, but at least hashkafically, he has the proper hashkafa. Look, would any of our shuls hire, if you brought in some Rav from B'nai Brak or Williamsburg, even if this person was Bucky and Kol HaTzarakula and Shas and Poskim, if he's an anti-Zionist, if he's a Satmar Chassid, would any of our shuls hire him, even though if he's a greater Talmud Chacham than a YU guy just out of Smicha? Of course not. So this idea that you should only go for the great Talmud Chacham, that's flawed, that argument. But in this case, the Mizrahi did make a terrible error, because Chaim Ozer was not some Satmar guy, not some crazy guy. And we'll see what the consequences for this were in a second. Rubinstein was elected by the Vada Kehila. The community did not vote. That is, the citizenry didn't vote. The Vada Kehila elected him chief rabbi, and the Aguda were a minority in Vilna. The election was 15-8, almost double. Rubinstein is elected. Now, I want to show you two pictures now, election posters. After Rubinstein was elected, there then were community elections. And this issue was used to get people out to vote for the Aguda ticket, because Orthodox were outraged. Let me show you. I'm going to leave my button here, which has my speaker. Let me open up. Coming up is one election poster. Talks about a Shrek Lechil Hashem. You have Greenbaum, and he's one of the leaders of the community, and Rubinstein. So he's telling everyone has to come out and vote for number 18 at the Aguda list. Because the terrible Lechil Hashem carried out by electing Rubinstein over Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski. And it quotes in there Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, Chafetz Chaim published an open letter calling the election a Bizayon HaTorah, a disgrace to the Torah. And it was a disgrace. Not to elect the Gadol Hador as Rav of Vilna was a slap in the face. Let me show you the other election poster now. Another election poster, once again, attacking Rubinstein. Remember, he was always respected by the Agud elements. He was a Talmud Chacham from Sabatka. He did a wonderful job as crown rabbi. And Rav Chaim Ozer was his friend. And yet when he was asked to be chief rabbi, the Mizrahi and others wanted him, and by agreeing to be chief rabbi, to run for chief rabbi, he really cut himself off. And the Aguda saw this as a terrible betrayal. And as far as they were concerned, he wasn't even regarded as a Rav. Although the relationships between Rav Chaim Ozer and him continued to be cool. Rabbi Rubinstein would come and wish Rav Chaim Ozer a good Shabbos every Shabbos. But for the Aguda newspapers, Rubinstein, it's almost like Rav Gorin. He lost any claim to legitimacy by what he did. Now, Chaim Grada, in his wonderful book, Rabbis and Wives, focuses on this event. That's the whole book, Rabbis and Wives, is built around this story, the running of the election between Rubinstein and Rav Chaim Ozer. And in the book, you have the old-time Rav and the more modern one, with Rubinstein obviously being the more modern one. Rubinstein's wife, Esther Rubinstein, a woman we'll speak about in a minute, she was actually dead by 1928. She dies in 1924, but in Grada's story, she is still alive, and in the story, it's her, that is Esther's wife, who really is encouraging her husband, the modern rabbi, that is Rubinstein, to run for, he keeps doubting himself, how can he run for this election, you have the great Rav, and she encourages him, and you see how he has the support of the younger generations. As with everything Grada writes, it's a wonderful book, but it's a bit of artistic license, because Esther Rubinstein was not alive. As I mentioned, the battle was led by Rav of his time with his open letter protesting this election, and in Vilna itself, the Chazon Ish. 1928, the Chazon Ish was not known. He was not a known personality, but he led the battle in Vilna, battle for Rav Chaim Moser's honor. Eventually, a compromise is reached because the Orthodox were so infuriated that the community figured that they need to reach some sort of compromise. And although Rubinstein remains chief rabbi, Rav Chaim Moser is reinstituted to his position as head of the Vod HaRabbanim. Today, people would say, well, why did they just create a separatist kehila, like in Frankfurt, where the Orthodox have their own kehila? But it wasn't even part of their conception. The whole notion was that the Jews have to stick together in one community. That's the way it always has been done, and there was tax money went to the Vada kehila. It would have been very difficult to change things. Rav Chaim Moser was reinstituted to the position he used to have, Vod HaRabbanim. Before this, there was a Vod HaRabbanim. There always was a Vod HaRabbanim before World War I, and Rav Chaim Moser, as the premier rabbi, was head of the organization of rabbis. So this really was defunct after the war, but they reinstituted it, and although Rubinstein is chief rabbi, Rav Chaim Moser is head of the rabbis, head of Vod HaRabbanim. What that means, really, in practice, it's really two power bases. But it was thought that this is throwing a fig leaf to the Orthodox, as the Aguda, giving Rav Chaim Moser some kavod. But as I said, supporting Rubinstein was a terrible, terrible move. Mizrahi. Many great rabbis stopped supporting Mizrahi after this. Among them, the second most important Rav in Vilna, on Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski's base, Rav Chanoch Aigis, the Marcheshes. Marcheshes was one of the Gedolei Yisrael in Eastern Europe. Vilna was a city of Rabbanim, and the Marcheshes was the second most important Rav in Vilna. Gaon of Gaonim, his Sefer is still published. He was not only Mizrahi, he was a public Mizrahi figure. He signed the letter in the early 1920s encouraging all rabbis in Vilna, in Lithuania, to join Mizrahi, to donate to Mizrahi. And after he saw what happened to his good friend, Chaim Moser said that he could never be, he could no longer support Mizrahi, so he signs for Mizrahi. He probably was the most prominent East European. I don't know if, when I say it's a terrible thing Mizrahi did, I don't even know, and I don't think anyone's written about, if the main Mizrahi office supported this. I find it hard to believe that Mayor Berlin, who was very close to all the Gedolim, including Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, would have supported this, but the Vilna Mizrahi supported it. And the main office of Mizrahi, as far as I know, never protested their actions. You can find similar examples in the Aguda. The Eda Haredit in Jerusalem, in Rav Kook's time, was officially connected to the Agudas Yisrael. And yet they did terrible things to Rav Kook, and although the Aguda leadership, Rav Chaim Moser and the others, were horrified by what happened, they did not publicly protest. And I'll even take it one step further. You had Eda Haredit people, violent types like you have today, who did terrible things. Wild kids. They once burnt Rav Kook in... They burnt him in effigy, and they had a so-called trial where they executed him at the end in this fake trial they had. And people like Rav Sonnenfeld refused to condemn these people. Why? Because, first of all, there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of fear that if the right-wing rabbis who opposed Rav Kook, but obviously didn't support these crazies, condemned, then they would then be attacked. And there were cases of where right-wing rabbis, Aguda rabbis, defended Rav Kook and attacked these people, and then they became subject to attack. When the Ger Rebbe came to the land of Israel, he was attacked for visiting Rav Kook. Also, these people, the Aguda and the very right-wing, the ones in Israel, they received their support from these people, and therefore they were tied with family ties and the rest with them. And I don't need to go back to the past. We have David Eisen listening to us right now. He's from Beit Shemesh. He can tell you that you have terrorists in Ramat Beit Shemesh, you have Natura Park, you have crazy people, and their rabbis do nothing to stop them. And I assume that their rabbis, David could correct me if I'm wrong, do not support the way they box and attack people. But yet, either because they're afraid of losing their own power base, or because they're tied in with these people in such incestuous relationships, whatever the reason is, they refuse to condemn them. you have these crazy people who go on rampages in Beit Shemesh and in Jerusalem and elsewhere, and the Rabbani, who everyone always assures us that this is done without the approval of the rabbis don't silence. The rabbis in these communities never say a word, they never protest, they just stand on by the side. So if you're going to condemn Mizrahi, because the Mizrahi leadership, the Mizrahi never condemned what the Vilna Mizrahi did, you have to look at Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael's hands are much dirtier in this, because they were officially connected with the Eda Haredit. And the Eda Haredit was responsible for all sorts of outrages, both not just the Eda Haredit, official Eda Haredit newspapers, but all the Eda Haredit wild people who were involved. And when the Polish Hasidim start coming to Eretz Yisrael and they see what the Eda Haredit and this extremism is all about, they then stop having anything to do with it. And this is really what leads to the break between Agudas Yisrael and the Eda Haredit, because the Aguda backers, that is the German Orthodox Jews, the Polish Jews, who were the backbone of Aguda, when they come to the land of Israel and they see who the worldwide Agudas Yisrael has aligned themselves with, they want nothing to do with them. That really becomes the last straw, and they need to break. You asked, did Rav Chaim Ozer care? What do you mean, did he care? Did he care that the Merchesheth? Rav Chaim Ozer loved the Vegas, and they were the closest of friends. Rav Chaim Ozer was an Aguda, and Chanuch Egas was a Mizrahi. This was a machlokas among Gedolim. Just like Rav Chaim Ozer had a machlokas with Rav Kook ideologically. Great, great Rabbonim, Rav Tzirilson, was an early supporter of Zionism. He later then becomes goes to the Aguda after the culture. Had in all the great European cities, you had Aguda Rabbonim, you had Mizrahi Rabbonim. They often sat on the same basin together. This was, Lithuania was not Hungary. Hungarian Rav could never sit with a Mizrahi. Want nothing to do with him. Lithuania, with few exceptions, Rav Chanan Wasserman is one, maybe the Chametz Chaim and the Chaim Soloveitchik, but the typical Rav, a city, a Lithuanian city, had Dayanim who were Mizrahi, everyone got along very nicely. Of course they disputed and they disagreed when it came to issues of religious Zionism. But on a day-to-day basis, when it came to halacha and matters of Beis Din, they all davened in the same shul together. The Mizrahi didn't have their shul, and they didn't have their shul. Every Rav in Eastern Europe, whether he was a Mizrahi Rav or an Aguda Rav, was elected by Aguda and Mizrahi together, because every city had Aguda and Mizrahi, and they voted. And in places where the Rav was really anti-Mizrahi, like in Brisk, Menachem Begin's father comes from Brisk. His father was a leading opponent of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and all the stories I heard from Rav Galevsky on the Yort side of Herzl, when they wanted, Rav Chaim said, you can't have the Hesped in the shul, so they climbed through the window. I mean, all sorts of strange stories. The fact is that these communities, people existed together with all the machlokes, with all the disagreement about Zionism. They remained in one kehila, or Rabbanim, respected Rabbanim, with certain exceptions. Rav Chaim Ozer always respected all the Rabbanim, the Mizrahi Rabbanim, disagreed. He was not a Mizrahi person. Just like he respected the German Rabbanim, he respected the Mizrahi Rabbanim. That's one of the differences. We'll do classes on Rav Chanan Wasserman, and we'll see how Rav Chanan Wasserman really should have been in Hungary. And today, his writings are reprinted by the Satmar. And you'll see a real extremism, and Rav Chaim Ozer had to deal with this extremism. It was his own brother-in-law. I'll deal with it a little bit next class. Rav Chanan Wasserman was really like a Hungarian person who just ends up in Lithuania. He did not have the typical Lithuanian tolerance. For the typical Litvak, if you were a Lamdin, that's the most important thing. Whether you're a Zionist or not, that's all secondary, if you knew how to learn. But if you think it's important that that the Mizrahi lost the Merchesheth, I'll tell you something. It's even worse. Rav Reines' son-in-law, Rav Aaron Rabinovitz, well-known figure, a Rav and a rabbi, and he wasn't a Rav of the community. A Talmud Chacham, though. As far as I know, he was never a Rav of the community. Maybe early on he was. He was actually the father-in-law of Rav Zipperstein. Anyone who went to Reek might remember Rav Zipperstein. He's the son-in-law of Rav Reines, the founder of Mizrahi, who we've done the classes about, abandons Mizrahi because of what they did to Rav Chaim Ozer. Now, Rubinstein wasn't just the son-in-law of Rav Reines. He was an active member of Mizrahi, an important figure, and he says after what the Mizrahi movement did to Rav Chaim Ozer, I can no longer be a member of Mizrahi. Now, neither of Agus For Rabinovitz stopped believing in the love of Eretz Yisrael and living in the land of Israel. They remained great supporters of living in the land of Israel, but would be involved in the political organization. Stop here now. There's a lot more to say. Continue, obviously. You asked, did Rav Chaim Moser care about Rav Rubinstein? All the biographies say that Rav Chaim Moser was very tolerant. With respect. Rav Chaim Moser never wanted to be Rav. Had he become Rav of Vilna when they wanted him to in 1906, none of these things would have happened. But so he never wrote anything, he never said anything. But the rest of the Gedolim of Eastern Europe said that in one of the letters, if I'm not mistaken, either it's a fine or someone else says, even though Rav Chaim Moser will not defend his own honor because he's too humble, it's not his honor, it's the honor of Torah. And therefore, we have to protest the terrible bizayon, the terrible disgrace to Torah. But it seems from all evidence so that Rav Chaim Moser personally, not only did he not get involved, he wasn't directing things from behind the scenes as rabbis sometimes do. The Chazon Ish directed it. Rav Chaim Moser, that for him, this wasn't a big issue. At least that's all the evidence that we have. There's a lot more still we need to do with Rav Chaim Moser, and we'll deal with how in the 1930s his tent, his wings really spread over not just all of Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, the land of Israel. And then we'll get into some of his halach decisions. A lot more to do with the great figure of Chaim Moser Grozinski. So if we have questions here or comments on what we've done today, I'll stay on a few minutes here. I'm going to speak about Esther Rubinstein for just a couple of minutes next class. We've spoken about Flora Sassoon, one of the great women in Jewish history. Esther Rubinstein is another one of the great women in Jewish history. If these Maharats in Riverdale knew about Flora Sassoon and Esther Rubinstein, they would put their picture right in front of their building as you walk in. Speaking of women Talmudic scholars, you can't put the Nechama Leibowitz. If you ask them who their heroes are, they'll all say Nechama Leibowitz. Kol kavod to Nechama Leibowitz, but she wasn't a Talmudic scholar. But Esther Rubinstein and Flora Sassoon, these are the two greatest women Talmudic scholars of the 20th century. Probably the two greatest traditional women scholars in the 20th century in any area, in terms of influence and just achievement. Rubinstein in terms of influence, Sephora Sassoon in terms of achievement. So come back next week to hear about Esther Rubinstein. Yes, Shlomo, the Sri Yesh was Maspid her. I will speak about that. Schneer Lyman translated this essay. You can find it in my volume, Collected Writings of Rav Chaim Weinberg, Volume 2. It appeared in the first edition of Leif Rakim, published in 1936. For some reason, in the second and third edition, they refused to include this essay, so I had to include it in the volume I published. It is one of Rav Chaim Weinberg's most wonderful essays, the essay on Esther Rubinstein, pious and learned woman. It's a crime they did not include this essay, especially since it's so pertinent to women in modern day, where now we give women Jewish educations. They used to not get Jewish educations. The fact that they did not include this essay, second and third editions, as I said, a crime. So we'll talk about that next class. Rav Yitzchak of Weinberg was very close to Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein. The whole family he was very close to. I'll tell you the story next class. Was the Torah Tamim a pro-Mizrahi? Supposedly. He was in America for a long time. He was in the Agudas Rabbanim. The Agudas Rabbanim was completely Mizrahi. There, until the 1930s, you didn't have any Aguda. All these great Rabbanim in America, the Agudas Rabbanim, were all Mizrahi. But I've never seen actual evidence from the Torah Tamim himself. But supposedly he was pro-Mizrahi. All the Rosh Yeshiva Reitz were pro-Mizrahi. But I don't know any more about the Torah Tamim. If one of the great bibliophiles online with us now can find the information, maybe Mr. Landerer, who's a great bibliophile, I'd be grateful for that. See some more typing. So, OK. Okay, I don't see anything else. Let me stay on 2 more minutes in case anyone wants to send any more comments or questions. I will be here next week. I'm saying this again, I don't know if Kelman's on, just to remind you, and I'll remind you again, in 2 weeks I will, God willing, be in the land of Israel. So I will not be here. I'll remind you next class, but if those of you who want to put it on your calendar, I will not be here. There's a conference at Ben-Gurion University on Jewish thought. I've been to Ben-Gurion University. I look forward to going there. Okay, well, Shlomo, it says you're typing, but maybe you're typing, I think if you're typing on the computer for something else, not typing in, maybe, you speak from there like David Eisen. Well, the difference is, unlike David Eisen, I need to get up at least 5:30. I mean, I sleep to at least 5:30. Apparently, David Eisen is a bit, like the Vilna Gaon, 8 hours or 2 hours of sleep a night is enough for him. But for me, it would be a little tough to do that. I don't know. I'll be with that. I'll be already in Ben-Gurion University, and they have planned for us there. So, skip 1 week. I will hopefully be in Ra'anana for Shabbos, which is a very nice place. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the questions and comments, and thank you, Shlomo, for encouraging me to look a little more into detail on Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Aguda. Look forward to seeing all of you next class, and hopefully we'll get this technology sorted out. My finger has been on the button, which is starting my finger for the last hour. So, good night, everyone.